Good evening, everyone. Thanks again for joining on the eve of Asara Bativis, which is, of course, a sad fast day in which we mourn the destruction of the temple. So we hope and pray that our Lima Torah and hopefully the moral improvement that results from our Lima Torah, because that's what our topic is all about, virtues and improving our character. So we hope that through that improvement, that through our Lima Torah, it can build one more brick in the Beit HaMikdash that we lost so long ago. I also want to mention that I'd like to dedicate our words of Torah this evening to Refuah Shleimah for Dov HaLevi Ben Kreindl, who is having a surgery in Florida. So we hope that that goes smoothly and it's a successful operation. So what we started doing last week was the Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avot. One of the things the Rambam wrote is the Pirush HaMishnah, a commentary on the Mishnah. And one of the parts of the Mishnah is Pirkei Avot, which is an interesting and unique portion of the Mishnah, which is focused on ethical and moral character and improvement rather than laws. And the Rambam told us last week to take it seriously. That even though, and I think we'll come back to this theme again, sometimes we think to ourselves, I don't need the sages to tell me about moral improvement or virtue or, what sort of way to interact with others or self-control or restraint. I got that all taken care of. I can figure that out on my own. And the Rambam says, and he's going to say again tonight, that no, you know what? It's not so simple. It's not so simple just to determine how to be a moral, virtuous person. And in fact, we would do ourselves a good favor by paying heed to the words of the sages in Pirkei Avot. Now, I wanted to do a brief review of what we saw last time. And what we saw last time was the Rambam's introduction really to the soul and what the soul is and how it expresses itself. So I'm going to share a brief PowerPoint presentation, just to do a quick review, because I think it's important, even though it is pretty theoretical. Let me just go to the slide. I'm going to start the slideshow so it's a little bit more visible. I apologize. Here we go. Okay. So if you remember, the Rambam told us last week something important, which is that we all have one soul. And what I argued last week was that the reason the Rambam emphasizes this, which is that even though there are various parts of our experience, we think, we eat, we sleep, we have emotions, we have feelings, we have an imagination, we have the five senses. And while the Rambam tells us that people in his day and age actually believe that there is more than one soul, the Rambam emphasizes to us that that's not so. We all have one soul. And I think the reason for that is because while the Rambam distinguishes between the five faculties or functions of the soul, they're all connected. We're one organism. And our intellectual selves, our emotional selves, our physical selves is one part of one entity. And that's why the Rambam can argue, as you will, that just like you can be physically sick and part of your body, certainly everyone would agree that if your digestive system isn't working, then that's a problem. There's a flaw. You need to go see a doctor, right? Because it's not functioning the way it's meant to function. So too the rest of our faculties. You can have a rational function that's not working appropriately, and you can have a different character traits that are sick, that are deficient, and they need to improve them, that they need correction. Because all of our parts of our being are meant to function in a certain way. And we need to pay heed to what those functions are, the way we're meant to function, so that we know that we function appropriately. So we're all part of one soul. And last week, we focused on the Rambam delineation of these five ways in which the soul functions. And so I'm just going to go over them briefly, or I tried to outline them for you here. This is sort of, let me, just gonna hide that little bar. I think I can, because I think it's pausing it, stopping me from seeing it. Bum 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 bum. What we got here? Hide video pad. That's not what I want. Hide floating media controls. There we go. Yes, I always wanted to figure out how to do that. So back to the sort of the slide over here. On the very base level, we have what he calls the zun, the nutritive, faculty, and those are the functions of our body, which function without our input. They just happen by themselves. Things like the digestive system, the respiratory system. Beyond that, you have the five senses, what he calls the margish, you know, touching, feeling, tasting, hearing. The third level, and we spent some time discussing this, because I, like you, I believe, was a bit intrigued by the Rambam's characterization of this. The Rambam's third faculty is the imaginative, the imagination. I think a few of you were a bit taken aback by this. We sometimes see the imagination as one of the highest faculties of humankind. We see the imagination as something we think of new ideas with or problem solve with. The way the Rambam refers to imagination, it's sort of just an extension of the five senses, right? So that I can imagine a sunny day and what that feels like and what it looks like. So when I'm actually there outside in the sun and I can imagine a warm, sunny day, I see it, I could feel it. I could see the sun, I could feel the heat. But if you live in Toronto and it's the cold winter, and the sunny day, the warm sunny day is a thing of the past, and you don't experience it very often. So you could go to Florida. That's always one option. But if you don't, you have your imagination. You can imagine, right, in your mind, you have an image and a sort of a sense of what you felt in the past. That's what the imagination is for the Rambam. And that's where he got into this notion that we can imagine things we even haven't experienced. Because we take something like a thousand-eyed monkey. You take something, you know what a monkey is, you can imagine it, you've seen eyes before, even if they're not in front of you right now, you can imagine what eyes are, and then you can conjure up an image of a 1,000-eyed monkey, even which to the Rambam means you can imagine things that don't exist. They don't have to reflect any reality. And it is interesting that for the Rambam, the imaginative faculty does not seem to be sort of the greatest expression of human individuality. It's sort of just an extension of our more base instinct. Beyond
Rabbi,
that,
Rabbi, yes. May I interrupt for a second? That there's a modern parallel today in terms of what the sports psychologists teach their players in terms of visualizing it so you can see success.
Right. As an extension of what you can see, exactly. But I 100%. I think the Rambam really sees this as simply a way of seeing something without physically seeing it. That's exactly what the imaginative faculty is for the Rambam. Beyond that, the next faculty the Rambam mentions is what he calls the mitorer, which is the faculty by which you desire things or don't desire things, or you avoid things or don't, right? So something like fear and courage. It's sort of the emotional realm of a person, a person's emotions. And then the last faculty is that of the rational faculty, which, and to no one's surprise who's been with us the whole time, but the Rambam is the highest faculty, the apex of what it means to be human, is ration, which includes acquisition of wisdom, number one, discerning the truth of the world, and also moral decision-making, knowing what is proper and improper, and even things that are more pragmatic, like craftsmanship, how to be an architect, or how to construct something, how to devise a plan. All of that's within the highest realm of functioning, which is the sikhli. And just a few more points about what we saw last time about these five faculties of the soul before we move on. Here we go. So the Rambam writes that number one, and this is, again, reflects what we saw a few weeks ago when the Rambam had his introduction to this work, where the Rambam writes that the highest end of humanity is reason. That is our form. A human being is meant to be a being with reason. That is what we are meant to acquire, such that if a person has a functioning soul, right, all of these five faculties function appropriately, but they don't come to reason, it's like a car that doesn't drive. That your soul isn't achieving what it has been set out to achieve, which is quite a worldview, but that we've seen before. And the other few things I wanted to mention was the realm of mitzvot. And the Rambam made a very interesting point here, which is that the Rambam first argues that on a basic level, mitzvot, the things we should do and should not do, lie in the two realms, the realm of the senses, what we taste, touch, smell, and feel. I can take a lulav with my hand. I can eat matzah with my mouth. So that's one realm. And also the more emotional realm, the things that I can either inculcate within me, like coveting. I could either desire something someone wants or I cannot desire what they want. Those are the two realms of mitzvah. It's interesting that the Rambam sees the realm of the ration, reason, logic, the intellectual realm. He says it's a philosophical debate as to whether or not there are mitzvot in that regard. He says it's not clear whether there can be intellectual mitzvot. He himself argues that there can be. We can be commanded to understand something that is true or not true, which does relate to the Rambam's notion that there is a mitzvah to believe in God, according to the Rambam, because the Rambam says it is the truth that there is a God, and your mitzvah is to come to that truth. That is a brief description of what we saw last time. But I want to sort of pose a question before we go further, and I think it's worth noting. So let me just stop and share for a second. This is how the Rambam describes the soul. Now, when we describe a soul, often we think of something sort of metaphysical, right? Something that's sort of spiritual, hard to define. But in the Rambam's description of the soul, which expresses itself through these five faculties, what do you think the Rambam is saying the soul is? Right? The Rambam's saying you have one soul that expresses itself in these five ways. It expresses itself in terms of how you think, how you feel, your emotions. So what is the soul? Is it this sort of mysterious metaphysical entity? What do we think? According to the Rambam, what would you say the soul is if it expresses itself in these five ways? Is there anything here supernatural in its essence?
It's like consciousness.
Right. It's like basic human functioning. The soul for the Rambam is the force which directs the totality of our experience. That is what the soul is. It's not some sort of metaphysical concept, you know, and if you look through this list, you might ask, where does the spirit come in? Right? That part of us, sort of that maybe has, you know.
Rabbi, I said consciousness, and consciousness is metaphysical, is it not?
In a sense.
It can be.
Metaphysical is a general term, but what I'm saying is sort of the part of you that might get lost in, you know, a sunset and transcend where people have these sort of mystical experiences and they feel like they're being, you know, transported from this world. You don't really see that very clearly in the Rambam here. The Rambam describes human functioning and it's very real. It's very pragmatic. It's just basic human experience. And that's what the soul is. The soul is made up of the things that we do every day.
But can you achieve that?
Sorry?
Can you achieve that if you're missing some of the senses? For example, it's a blind, deaf person. Can they achieve that?
Can they achieve? I mean, it's a good question. The Ram would say that it would be harder. I don't doubt that. That they're not functioning appropriately, and that's a shame, and it's a challenge. But what I'm sort of trying to say is I think you have a very grounded view of reality and spiritual achievement. So when the Rambam describes virtue, he's describing a way of living in a very practical way. You don't need to go sort of meditate or escape from this reality in order to achieve moral perfection or virtue. It's simply a matter of making sure that all of these five functions are working appropriately. And I think that's a very particular perspective in terms of what the Rambam sees as the point of life versus what you might find from some other thinkers. Sorry. Say any more questions or observations about that? Yeah, go for it, Gail.
Is there, I'm not sure I remember what the Hebrew said, but was he using the word nefesh or neshama?
Yeah, nefesh. He did not use the word neshama.
So like, I mean, like when we talk about like, for example, a soulmate or something like that, and I think of the word neshama. I don't really think of the word nefesh. I don't. Maybe it's just semantic.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Like in Kabbalah, for instance, but I think that's what we're describing. There's like different. There's the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama. And there's a part of this notion that there's a part of your soul that's sort of still with God, and you're sort of connected to and these higher worlds. I don't think the Rambam would really relate to that at all. I think the Rambam is very much geared in this world and the way that we function in normal life. I think that's very, you know, in terms of the way he said he views the soul, it's really enlightening in a certain sense, in contrast to the way others do. So at this point, I want to go on to the second part of the Shmona Prakim. I'm going to share my screen again. This 1 second, please. And we'll continue reading here. And what I'm going to try to do, because the Hebrew is difficult, so I'm going to try to read from the English, but I'm going to keep the Hebrew up there because some of the English translation here is frankly a bit complicated in and of itself. But I'm going to read from the English, so, and hopefully that will make it a bit easier to follow. And again, these are sort of abstract concepts, but I do find them meaningful. So I'm going to begin again from where we were up to, which is in chapter 2. Over here, briefly. Okay, here we go. And I think we're up to here. Amnon. So we talked about where the realm of mitzvot and averot are. They're primarily in the realm of, you know, our emotions and our actions, essentially. Amnon. Sorry. Now, as to the virtues, they are of two kinds. Virtues, moral and intellectual, with the corresponding two classes of vices, right? So there, now the Rambam tells us there are two types of virtues, positive attributes. And then corresponding to those two positive attributes, there are two types of negative attributes, okay? And I'd like to ask you a question. It's a basic point, but I think it's worth reflecting on. The Rambam already discussed where mitzvot and averot are, right? Where commandments, two tough things we should do and shouldn't do are. So beyond mitzvah and avera, what are these virtues? What are these what virtues, positive attributes are there aside from doing what God wants and not doing what he wants? What is he describing here? That's a very basic question. What do you think he means
I think it refers to good things that one can do that he figures out on his own without backing from God.
Okay. If I were to ask you,
like chesed, right?
Well, chesed might be a mitzvah, though, right? Kindness. I'm saying, if I were to ask you beyond the realm of the things specific, that God tells us to do and not to do, what other virtues should we aspire to? I mean, think about it. Is everything that you try to be, you aspire to be, or you might tell your children or grandchildren to be, is it all in the realm of mitzvot and averot?
Not because there's 613 mitzvahs, and in life there's lot, right? So many other that things that you can do beyond 613.
I think the point the Rambam
makes here. That's for mitzvahs.
Right. But I think the point the Rambam makes here, and I think it's a very basic one, is that there are lots of things that are not included in that. Very basic virtue. For instance, things like being patient or not being patient. Things like being slow to anger. Things like, quote-unquote, self-control. Where does it say in the Torah you're not allowed to be arrogant, for instance? Or where does it say in the Torah that you are meant to acquire proper wisdom? You might find a commandment for it, you might not. The Rambam here clearly sees that there are certain things we have to strive for which are not explicit mitzvot and averot. That they're not one of the 613. But they're a basic part of what we're meant to aspire to in life. They are malo, they're virtues. They are part of what it means to be a good person, to be a virtuous person. So I think that in and of itself is worth noting. Right, that we're not simply here to do the things that God wants us to do and not the things he doesn't want us to do, but there is a greater ethic here. There's a greater thing to aspire to that spans beyond any specific action. So let's read what the Rambam describes.
And how does he derive that from the Torah?
That's a good question.
What about deriving knowledge, technical knowledge?
Right. The Rambam
says things work. The way things work. I mean, the Torah doesn't tell us how a machine works.
Well, that's exactly it. So let's read a little bit, and then I'll, I'm happy to hear what you think. So he says, now as to the virtues, there are two classes. The intellectual virtues belong to the rational faculty. They're intellectual virtues. They are not mitzvot. They are things that you should try to acquire. They are wisdom, which is the knowledge of direct and indirect causes of things based on a previous realization of the existence of those things. That's a lot of words. So I think what Rambam here is describing is, the way things work in the world on a very basic level, right? So you might describe how a plant grows, and you've noticed it. You've witnessed the process. You witness how the sunlight interacts with the watering and that whole process, right? So it's the cause of the growth. That's knowledge, number one, acquire knowledge. And then reason. Reason here is beyond the things that we know, but the ability to think. The ability to think, consisting of inborn theoretical reason, certain things we just come with naturally, and the acquired intellect, the things that we acquire as we go through life. And then three, these are all virtues. What he calls sagacity here, the ability to think quickly, intellectual cleverness, to perceive things quickly, to grasp an idea without delay or in a very short time. These are all objectively attributes we should aspire to. They're positive things that a person should try to achieve. You know, some people have less or more trouble. I think I read this and I wonder, is the Rambam saying that some people have this or don't? Is this something that you can work? I have a feeling that's what Paul's going to ask. Can you work to acquire this, or is it just sort of given to you? It's not 100% clear, but the Rambam does describe it as a virtue, something that is virtuous. It is positive. So that's in terms of intellectual.
But why is the ability to perceive quickly a virtue?
How long? I don't think he means rushing, but what I think he sees it as a virtue is because when you're, how long does it take you to understand something? People who understand things more quickly, that's seen as virtuous.
But maybe people who understand take a little longer time will understand all the ramifications. And the person who perceives something very quickly doesn't understand all the ramifications of the fact of what they're acquiring.
Right, so I think that would be a different category. There's how quickly you understand things and how well you understand them. But if you can understand it well and quickly, I think the Rambam is arguing that those things are virtuous. Okay. The Rambam, by the way, is going to.
Otherwise, it might be Bittul Torah.
Bittul Torah. I don't know if the Rambam is even talking about that category. I think he's talking very generally. There are different categories of intellectual virtue. One of them is the speed at which you perceive and understand things, and one of them is the fact that you understand things appropriately. They're two different categories. So that's in terms of intellectual virtue. And then the vices, meaning the negative aspects, the deficiencies would be of this factor, the antitheses, the opposites of these virtues. So if you don't understand things, it takes you a really long time to understand things. The second, moral virtues belong only to the appetitive faculty, which I'm telling you is the realm of desire and emotion, to which that sensation in this connection is merely subservient, right? Meaning our feelings, the things that we touch, the things that we taste, they are driven by our desires. They're driven by our emotions. The virtues of this faculty are very numerous. And here I was going to say a lot of them, meaning liberality. And here I'm going to try to read the Hebrew because I don't think the translation is so perfect. Nedivut, meaning the ability to be generous and to give. Honesty, meekness, anava. Right? Humility. And he sees, it's interesting, those are two different things here. There's anava and shiflut. To me, I would argue what he's saying here is, number one, there's a way that, you think of yourself. How does one think of themselves? Do you sort of, think of yourself as, very high and above everybody else, like internally? And there's another category, which is how you carry yourself around others. Like, do you walk around with a certain, strut or a certain way of carrying yourself and presenting yourself, or do you walk around less so? Now, the Rambam, as we'll see, none of these are so simple. What is the appropriate virtue in each of these? The Rambam is going to explain. histapka, contentedness, not needing too much. And he quotes Pirkei Avot, which rabbis call wealth when they say who is truly wealthy, who is contented with his lot. Courage, faithfulness, and other virtues akin to these. The vices of this faculty consist of a deficiency or an exaggeration of these qualities. Okay, so there, he listed a lot of different things there. A lot of different moral virtues. There's humility, contentedness, courage. Now, I think it's interesting to consider how the Rambam is being so meticulous about thinking about so many of these. There are so many categories of moral virtue that the Rambam is telling us that it's appropriate to focus on. There's so many elements of this. And I think sometimes we don't really focus on this too much. We don't focus. How often do we go through our character and think, you know, am I content enough or do I desire too much? How do I carry myself among other people? All of these are different categories and different virtues which are part of achieving moral perfection. And he says, regarding the faculties of nutrition and imagination, it cannot be said they have vices or virtues. And again, back to imagination being a lower quality. But the nutritive functions work properly and improperly. As for instance, when one says that a man's digestion is good or bad, or that one's imagination is confused or clear. Certain faculties either function well or they don't, but they're not virtuous in that it's really hard to control them. This does not mean, however, they are vices or virtues or vices. Because again, they're sort of out of the realm of your control. So much we wish discussed in this chapter. So that's the end of chapter 2, where the Rambam delineates the realm of mitzvah and averot and which faculty that's relevant to, and also the realm of virtue and deficiency. So here, before we do chapter 3, I would like to ask a question. Before we get to what the Rambam wants to teach us in chapter 3, which is as follows. Say a person decides they would like to improve their character, right? Say a person decides that they have sort of a temper. They're short, they're easily angered. People get them angry quickly. They get too angry too often. Whom should a person consult in such a situation? What should a person do to repair that anger? What would you say? If someone comes to you and says, you know what, I'd like to work on my temper. That's a good step in and of itself. What should a person do to actually work on that? What would you say? What do you think?
Spiritual psychological advisor.
Spiritual psychological advisor. Interesting. Like, what sort of person would that be?
I suppose a kind of religious psychiatrist.
A religious psychiatrist. Okay. Now, what if a person said, you know what? I'm just going to work on it by myself. I don't need a religious psychiatrist. I'm good. I'm going to work on it by myself. What do you think about that being an advisable sort of?
You always need someone to make sure that you're operating within proper confines of thought.
Why?
Because you could think yourself. What? You could why? Think yourself. Why? Because individuals often don't see the truth. They see what's good for them. So you need some sounding board. Is helpful, and on top of the sounding board, you've got somebody who can give you directions if you're moving out of a zone that takes you a little bit out of reality, where you don't see exactly what's happening, the truth of what's happening.
Beautiful. I think
You've heard the expression, can I bounce this idea off you?
Right, exactly. But here's my question. I'm actually curious about this. And you don't have to answer, but how many people here would consider asking someone for advice in the realm of moral improvement? Let me ask it again. When was the last time one of you asked someone for advice and how to improve on one of your character traits?
I would do that, but I would probably pick a person that didn't have such a problem with temper.
Or right, okay.
Someone who has solved the problem to a large extent.
Right.
Had a problem and solved it might even be better.
Would you? So that's great.
Or someone you didn't know.
Someone you didn't know, because it's embarrassing, right? Let me tell you something. It's just interesting. Like, when you're in yeshiva, for those of us who went to yeshiva, this is like a big emphasis, right? And there's like a mashgiach, or someone that's a rabbi that's dedicated toward improvement, and you would ask them, you know, and Rabbi, I'm struggling with this midah. But you know what? I would argue that we rarely do this. Really? I mean, think about it. When was the last time you asked a spiritual advisor, whether it's a rabbi, a teacher, someone you respect, that you're for advice when you're struggling not with a specific question? And I don't even mean like halacha question. I don't even mean, you know, a moral quandary in terms of what do I do? Do I do X and Z? But when was the last time we asked somebody, you know what, I have a problem with, I don't know, I have a bit of a lack of self-control. And could you help me improve in that regard? I don't think we do it very often. You know what the Rambam says? You absolutely have to. Just like the Rambam is going to say, just like if a person is physically ill, all of us, if we're physically ill, in a serious way, would go to a physician. You wouldn't think twice about it, right? Someone who could treat you. So in the same sense, a person who is quote-unquote sick, who has a deficiency of the soul, and again, the soul isn't some sort of spiritual, metaphysical concept. A sickness of the soul means one of these virtues in which a person's deficient in. They have to seek guidance from someone who, as Martin was saying before, now, who that is, he's called them Chachamim, the wise. Take a look what he says here. The ancients maintained, and I don't know who the ancients are. Are they the Chachamim, or is it Aristotle philosophers? Not 100% clear. The Rambam told us he's not going to give us any names here, so your guess is as good as mine. But the ancients maintained that the soul, like the body, is subject to good health and illness. The soul's healthful state is due to its condition and that of its faculties, by which it constantly does what is right. All the five things you mentioned before can be healthy or not healthy, and performs what is proper, while the illness of the soul is occasioned by its condition and that of its faculties, which results in its constantly doing wrong and performing actions that are improper, right? So if a person has the wrong character trait, right? So a person, say, is a bit too quick to spend money, that's going to result in them spending too much and buying too many things that they don't need. It's going to result in improper action. They're sick. They're not functioning appropriately.
You're talking about my ex-wife?
I'm going to ignore that comment and go on. Thanks, Paul. Which is also it's constantly doing wrong and performing actions that are improper. The science of medicine investigates the health of the body. And just as those who are physically ill imagine that on account of their vitiated taste, the sweet is bitter and the bitter is sweet. Right? So the Rambam is saying when you're sick, you might have the impression that certain things are good for you and certain things are not. They might even feel a certain way to you, but that might be a function of the fact that your body is not working appropriately. And likewise, fancy the wholesome to be unwholesome. And just as their desire grows stronger and the enjoyment increases for such things as dust, coal, very acidic and sour foods and the like, which the healthy loathe and refuse, as they are not only not beneficial even to the healthy, but possibly harmful. So a person who's sick, whose body does not function appropriately, might desire certain things and they think it's going to help them, but it's doing the opposite of helping them. It's going to harm them. If that's true in the realm of the physical self, so too, those whose souls are ill, I'm going to try to, let me use my cursor on so you can follow, that is the wicked and the morally perverted, right? Balei midot hara'ot. Imagine that the bad is good and that the good is bad. The wicked man, moreover, continually longs for excesses which are really pernicious, but which on account of the illness of his soul, he considers to be good.
But how many people whose soul is ill will admit that their soul is ill? Isn't that the crux of the problem? You said how many people will reach out for help? You have to know that you need help before you reach out for help. So if your soul, if you have problems with your soul, if you're ill, you're probably of the ilk not to reach out.
That's a good question. How do you, and he's going to say that's a real problem. How do you know how to reach out? That's interesting to think about. How would a person even get the, I guess you have to have a certain self-awareness at some point where you physically, you might know, I mean, you're making a good point, frankly. A person has to be healthy enough to know that they're sick to then go seek that advice. I think you're making a good point. You know, there's a basic sensitivity to know that I think I need to change the direction, right? I think your point is a good one. I think it's a fair question. What do you think, Gail?
I think I was always taught, like, even if you pull out a dime instead of a quarter when you want a quarter, that's Hashem's way of talking to you, that maybe you're supposed to be thinking.
Maybe there's like, signs, right? There are certain signs. I'm not sure the Rambam himself would agree with that particular perspective. But I hear maybe there are signs, but it's a fair point. But I guess it's something you have to be sensitive to. Likewise, just as when people unacquainted with the signs of medicine realize they are sick and consult a physician who tells them what they must do, right? Forbidding them to partake of that which they imagine beneficial and prescribing for them things that are unpleasant and bitter, in order their bodies may become healthy. Sometimes the medicine is disgusting. It's horrible. It feels bad. It's unpleasant. The treatment's unpleasant. And that they maybe again choose the good and spurn the bad. So too, those whose souls become ill should consult the sages, the moral physicians. And that's what sages are, moral physicians, who will advise them against indulging in those evils, which they think are good, so that they may be healed by that art of which I shall speak in the next chapter. He's going to say how you recalibrate your virtue, and through which the moral qualities are restored to a normal condition. And I think what he's hinting to also is that it might not be so pleasant. And what the quote-unquote sage tells you might seem like, no, I don't want to do that. That's going to be painful. That's going to be hard. That's going to be uncomfortable. But the Rambam is telling you, you need to sort of have trust. Now, if you ask me the question, well, who's to say they're a sage and who's not to say they're a sage? I hear that. That's a pretty good question. There's a certain almost, you know, superiority in this. There's the sages, and they are experts in the arts of spiritual healing and spiritual medicine. You have to seek them in order to heal your soul.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
When one has a physical problem and goes sees a doctor, they might want a second opinion. They might want a third opinion. There are people like that.
Right.
So if you want to improve on your nefesh, on your soul, maybe you need a few opinions. Is that possible?
Yeah, I would say so. He doesn't say chacham, he says the chachamim. It's in plural, in fact, right? You have sheyishalu hachachamim, ask the sages in plural. It's fair to seek more than one opinion. Seems like a fair observation. Might not be so simple. I think what your point though is that there the Rambam is seeing this as an illness which should have a solution. There should be an approach to make this better, as opposed to the notion that I feel like we often have, which is like, listen, I was born a certain way and that's the way I am. And look, that's the way it's going to be. The Rambam doesn't really sort of accept that. And I think it's a certain tendency to be static and to sort of be satisfied with where we are, where the Rambam's saying, no, you have to fix yourself. You're not, you're sick. And look what he says here. And this is a pretty extreme way of saying it. But if he who is morally sick, or she, be not aware of this illness, if someone doesn't realize that they're sick, like this is Paul's problem. What if I don't know if I'm sick? Imagining that he is well or being aware of it does not seek a remedy. You know, I know I'm sick. I know I have a problem. Whatever realm that is, I spend too much money. The Rambam say I spend too little money. You know, I have too much sort of respect for myself, and I think I'm better than everyone else, or I have no respect for myself. I have no dignity, and I walk around like a schlump in a schlamazel. And those are both sicknesses, the Rambam will say. If I don't do anything about it, his end will be similar to that of one who's suffering from bodily ailments. yet continuing to indulge himself, neglects to be cured, and who in consequence surely meets an untimely death. Now that's a pretty extreme statement. Those who know they are in a diseased state, but nevertheless yield to their inordinate passions, are described in the truthful law, the Torah, which quotes their own words. This is a pasuk that is in Devarim, which says, "Leman ki b'shirut libi lebeich, leman sefot harava et hatzmeya," to add on the thirsty, or the person who is wet or satiated to the thirsty, which means, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart, in order that the indulgence of the passions may appease the thirst for them. This means that in intending to quench the thirst, the person has a thirst, they have a desire, they have an indulgence, something that burns within them, and they want more and more and more of it. And they keep giving in to that desire. It is on the contrary intensified. The more you take, the more you want. Right? Now, I wonder out loud. I am not sure. The Rambam says, just as is someone who is physically sick, if they just ignore the sickness, or if they aren't aware of the sickness, the results can be fatal. So too, someone who is spiritually sick and they have a moral deficiency, the result can be fatal. Does he mean literally fatal? It's hard to imagine that's the case. Is there some sort of almost irretrievable point? Do they just continue to get, maybe what he's saying is it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Wow, that, it builds on itself.
He might be saying, like the Torah says that, the Torah says that if we sin, God could take us out of the world. So maybe that's what he's referring to.
You think
to.
He really means
God, God removes from the world if they're going down the bad path.
But, okay, maybe. I mean, I just heard that find it hard to believe. You think you're really going to die if you don't correct yourself? But sorry, Paul, you were saying?
Rabbi, most of us go to the doctor once or twice a year for a physical checkup. Get a blood pressure taken, you listen to your heart, and if something's wrong, they do an x-ray, they take all these things. How many of us go to a head doctor once or twice a year to see whether our moral compass is pointing in the right direction?
That's what exactly what he's saying here.
We
That's
don't
what he's saying you gotta do.
But we don't. Society well, today
I think part of the reason why
doesn't do that.
Yeah. Sorry.
And I think the reason they don't do it is because they don't want to do it. Why? Because we follow our Yetzer Horas more than we follow our Yetzer or Toves. I think most of us do. Would you agree with that? Most
that,
of us
I think
follow
that
our
might
Yetzer
be part of it
rather than our Yetzer Toves. And we don't want to go to a spiritual healer who is going to curtail our Yetzer Hara. That our lives will go down the drain.
Yeah, I mean, I think of a few things. I can think of a few reasons people don't, and I'm wondering what other people think. Why we don't heed this advice to the Rambam. We don't go to this quote-unquote spiritual here. Number one, I'm not sure any of us has one. Meaning, you know, how many of us have a figure in our lives whom we trust to guide us morally, to instruct us in terms of our character traits? I think there's a certain mistrust of, you know, if it's supposed to be the rabbi, do I really trust the rabbi? Or maybe the rabbi knows, you know, he tell me my pot needs to be toveled or not. He might even be able to tell me, you know, what I should do if I'm in a tough slot, but to tell me just how to be a better person. I don't need, you know, either I don't need the rabbi for that or I don't trust the rabbi for that. I think part of it's because it's embarrassing, isn't it? To go to someone and say,
I think it's the ones that are already converted to.
Sorry?
I think it's only those who are already converted to this type of thinking, to this way of life. They're the ones that are going to seek further advice. But people that are into promoting their own desires don't want to go to spiritual healers because they're going to, they're going to avoid that.
So I think part of this discussion hopefully is helpful in at least getting us to think about in this way of, of am I spending enough time considering how I might improve in these areas? And who's going to go through all of them? Let's just go a little further, because I'd like to finish this point and see some of the virtues. Again, mind just go a little further, just to finish this at least point. And he points a few verses to this effect, that a person who is not thinking about these sort of things, of moral improvement and virtue, is going to continue doing the exact things that put them in that place in the first place. So he quotes in Mishlei, the way of the fool is straight in his own eyes, but he who listens unto the counsel is wise, right? It actually has a nice ring to it in the translation, right? It rhymes. Shomel atzach hacham, mishu yodeyu hader shu yashar b'emet, right? A person, this means that he who listens to the counsel of the sage is wise. The sage teaches him the way that is actually right, and not the one he erroneously considers to be such. And he also says, there is many a way which seemeth even before a man, but its end are ways unto death. Again, in regard to these who are morally ill and that they do not know what is injurious from that which is beneficial. And again, the way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know against what they stumble. The art of healing the diseases of the soul will ever form the subject matter of the fourth chapter. So in this third chapter, the Rambam is simply telling us that just as someone who is physically ill needs to seek a physical doctor, a physician, someone who is spiritually ill needs to seek a chacham. And simply saying, I'm going to take care of it myself is not an appropriate path, because the thing that you think might help you might indeed be injurious to that exact area that you're working on. Now, and as we noted, we don't often do this. And you know, maybe it's worth considering doing it more often, finding that person whom it is we trust and having sort of a spiritual checkup. And even more, just to think in this regard, I think most people would say that, you know, I don't know, physical, spiritual checkup, moral improvements. I mean, like, who needs that, right? Like, come on. And you know what else I think? And I wonder if you agree. I think that we sort of relegate this area to the kids, right? Because we all know when you go to elementary school or your little children we know that teachers are supposed to not just teach them how to add or how to subtract or how to multiply or how to divide, but they're there to teach them how to be a mensch, you know, patience and how to work hard and how to have proper manners. And but for some reason, that moral education, it seems to me at least, and this is something Rabbi Sacks used to talk about at great length, moral education, teaching the appropriate way to live and virtues and how to achieve those virtues, we sort of relegate to that area of our lives. And once we get to even middle school or high school, it's almost like out the window. And what we focus on is almost like a way of sort of, you know, adding and subtracting and even more geometry and calculus and biology. And all those things are important, but it's never again about virtue. We don't focus on those things. And I think the Rambam would be very critical of that. And unless the person say, because those things are just obvious, they're not so obvious. The Rambam's whole point here is it's not so obvious how to work on a person's virtue and how to work on their character. It's actually very difficult. In fact, someone who is struggling might think that everything that cures them is going to make it worse.
How does our Torah refer to virtue? It seems... My question is, how does the Torah refer to virtue, our Torah? Because it seems like the Rambam has created his own category.
So the Rambam, it's a great question.
See this virtue in the Torah.
Yeah, in the Yalach HaZakah, the Rambam sees a commandment to be virtuous in the commandment of Halachta B'drachav, to follow in his ways. Remember, we read that together. To follow in the path of God. And as the Chazal say, Mahu Rachum Afatarachum. She says, he is merciful, you should be merciful. And
there is one other statement.
Just one second, Martin. He invokes the pasuk from Mishlei. One second. He invokes the pasuk from Mishlei, which says, B'chol drachecha de'ehu. Know him in all of your ways.
Yes.
So it's an all-inclusive sort of commandment. But I'll also add, and I think this is the point I was making before, I'm not sure the Rambam needs a commandment for this. He thinks it's just basic. I mean, you have to know what the virtues are. But that you need to strive to be virtuous is just obvious based on what we're here to do. We're here to be virtuous and to acquire wisdom. That's what we're here for. So, of course, you have to do that. If not, you won't be accomplishing a purpose. I just want Gail. Marta, just give me 1 second. Gail, okay. Did you want to say something?
I have just two short things. One, I can't help thinking about when the new U.S. Supreme Court justice was appointed. You know, people were making fun of her and her husband, that supposedly they used some kind of person to help them make decisions, or to help them even in terms of like when they should have when they should adopt those children in addition to their own natural children, and people looked kind of askance at it. It was interesting because like it's kind of something similar, like that they went out to someone else. I mean, I have a friend who is Lubavitch, and she used to ask the Lubavitch rabbi some of these. It could overlap with some of these areas.
It's interesting, but it's interesting because even those examples you gave, like, what do you ask the Rebbe for? You go to the Rebbe and you ask him, you know, my daughter is having trouble finding a shidduch. Can you pray for her? Or and not to take light of that. That's really important. But how often do we just ask, you know what? I'd like to work on X. How can you help me? A very basic question in terms of the way we function every day of our lives. And that we don't ask. We sort of, either we do it intuitively, we hope we're going to figure it out on our own, we don't even think about it, we just kind of go along the route.
You're right. I think people are more private, and they probably ask either, you know, someone in their family or a close friend.
If they do, but yeah, I hear you, Paul. You want to say something?
But society has established a set of rewards that are based on material advances rather than spiritual advances, and rather than being a virtuous person. I mean, to be a gunner and to be successful in business, you're held much higher in society than a person who is a religious person who follows the teachings of the Torah. So maybe we've got a lot of these things just screwed up and turned right around.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're saying it's a certain counterculture we have to build up. And I think you're right. You know, I'm not sure society always rewards the virtuous person. You know, certainly politics seems to not. It seems that often you have to look to get whatever advantage you can, regardless of honesty or, you know, understanding to the other side. You know, so I think you're making it's not always rewarded. So let's look a little bit about, and that in chapter 4, the Rambam promotes his view of what virtue is, what sort of attributes are virtuous, and how you might acquire them. And here's where the Rambam will begin. Now, let's just begin a little further, and then maybe I'll take a few questions after or comments. Where the Rambam described is very well-known Tzvil HaZahav, the golden mean. And there's a very particular perspective the Rambam has in achieving that golden mean, I think is really worth thinking about. I think some of these are a bit surprising. So Rambam writes here, good deeds are as such are equal balance, maintaining the mean between two equally bad extremes. So there's always two extremes. You could call them, one's the positive extreme, one's the negative extreme. And the good, the virtue is in the middle. The too much and the too little, right? That's in terms of deeds, actually. That seems like too much is usually too many. Doing too much of something is usually an issue. And doing too little of something is also an issue. You want to have, you know, somewhere in the middle. Virtues, not masin, not good deeds, but virtues are psychic conditions, you know, psychological. And dispositions which are midway between two reprehensible extremes. You don't want the extremes. One of which is characterized by an exaggeration, the other by a deficiency. So there's always too much of a certain virtue or too little of that. And then he gives us some examples. And then good deeds are the product of these dispositions. If you want to do what is right, you need to have the right character, traits, and deeds flow from that character. To illustrate, and this is a crazy word, abstemiousness, but essentially means restraint, self-control. So self-control is a disposition which adopts a mid-course between inordinate passion and total insensibility to pleasure. So the Rambam is saying, the person finds either that they have an incredible desire for a specific pleasure, whether it's food, or, you know, sexuality or whatever it is, whatever physical pleasure is, and they want more and more and more and more of it. That's an extreme. That's a problem. But on the other hand, being totally insensitive to that, the person never wants to eat or doesn't seem to get any sort of pleasure about what should be pleasurable, right? Seems to have no desire for pleasure in this world at all. That's also inappropriate. That's a deficiency. The middle ground is restraint. What he's calling here in Hebrew, zihirut. Zihirut means to be zahir, to be careful, to be thoughtful about our decisions, to not rush into any particular pleasure, but also to not abstain from it completely. So that's the middle ground, right? Abstemiousness, restraint then, is a proper rule of conduct. And the psychic disposition which gives rise to it is an ethical quality. If you can get to the point where you find that you have control, if you can build up those emotions within you that lead you to a habit of not partaking of too much pleasure, but also not abstaining from it altogether, that is what you need to try to achieve. But the opposite, but again, inordinate passion, the extreme of excess, and total to insensibility to enjoyment, the extreme deficiency, are both absolutely pernicious. Ra gamor. They're both a problem. And it sounds like he thinks they're both equally a problem. Whereas I might have said, listen, to have too much pleasure, that's really bad. To have not enough, you know, okay. The Rama thinks they're both equally ra. The psychic dispositions from which these two extremes, inordinate passion and sensibility, result the one being an exaggeration, the other deficiency, are alike class among moral imperfections. If you find within yourself certain feelings or thoughts that bring you to a state of either taking too much or taking too little, that is a problem. That is something you need to control and correct. And he has a lot of categories with this. V'chein nidivut. Nidivut meaning the willingness to give and give and give and give, right? So nidivut actually here is rational giving. That's the middle. Memutza ben akilut. Kilut meaning miserliness, you know, frugality, not wanting to give or spend anything. And then pizur, you know, constant, what he calls here, extravagance, always spending, always looking to spend, to give away, give it all away, and without the ability to control that. None of those are good. What you want is what he calls nidivut. Nidivut means the willingness to give, but not to a extravagant degree. Givura, courage. Mimutsapena misiralisa kanovirach levav. And I think this is another interesting thing to consider nowadays. Givura means courage. Courage is positive. But courage doesn't mean being reckless. You know, we all have a certain propensity to risk, a certain risk tolerance. Courage is the appropriate risk tolerance. Recklessness is too much. Cowardice is too little. If a person's if a person went to the realm and said, you know what, I'm just going to be careful. I'm going to be careful. I don't want to put myself in danger. I'm going to be very, very, very careful. At a certain point, the Rambam would say, if you are careful to the point where it's cowardice, where you're not willing to take certain risks, which are not reckless, which are worthwhile risks, then that's a problem too. There has to be a balance between recklessness and cowardice, right? Hesitancy. And last, dignity between hitnasut and nivala. You shouldn't walk around like you're God's gift to the world, and you shouldn't walk around like a shlump or a shlamazel, like you're like a nothing, but you need to walk around with dignity. All of these, so the Rambam is saying here that there's a middle ground. Extremes are to be avoided. Extreme of any particular attribute or sensibility or tendency is something that is a problem, whether in a negative way or a positive way. And so when we continue next time, the Rambam will read how the Rambam says, well, what do I do if I find that I'm veering in a certain sense? Or, you know, how much is too much? So we'll pick up with that. We'll pick up with that all right. Next time. Thank you all for joining. Hope you found this
inspirational.
And please, God, let's all try to at least be sensitive to growth in virtue and morality and building our character traits such that we can try to achieve the greatest virtue that we can. Thanks, everybody. Easy, meaningful, fast, everybody.